In this second half of Evagrius Practicos, we move from a categorizing of the forms of temptation and a description of some of the remedies that can be useful against them to what Evagrius will call a gnostikoteros, a more contemplative understanding of this interior warfare, this battlefield which is the heart, and his goal will be to enable the individual to perceive the experience of temptation, the nature of their own interior struggle as data, as information, which they then ask the meaning of from Christ in order to discern both the appropriate remedies that ought to be applied and to get a sense of how one then should move forward, how one should engage in the process of making spiritual progress on the basis of what one's learned about oneself. So we begin in number 40 with his description of the fact that it isn't always possible to engage in the whole complex of one's ascetical assignments or projects. Whatever I normally do, that I take a certain amount of time for Lectio Divina, that I engage in a certain amount of time for private prayer, the reality of our lives is that we will have occasions when we will not be able to do what we normally set aside time for. And the question then is, how do we make prudential decisions? How do we exercise discretion, discernment in determining what we can reasonably do? And in other circumstances, what about when we're physically ill? What can we expect ourselves to do? What kinds of expectations should a person have of ascetical striving? And his emphasis here is on the idea of kairos, of a proper and opportune time, of having an appropriate measure, a sense of what is proper and best, what best fulfills or serves the purpose towards which all of these activities are intended to lead. And ultimately, of course, the purpose is presence to God. The purpose is prayer. So if one finds oneself convinced that despite the fact that I'm sick, I really ought to be engaging in all these excessive ascetical practices, that's probably demonic, according to Evagrius. It's probably a temptation. It's not really an encouragement to, as he puts it, simply when one is ill, giving thanks in pain and being patient and receiving ministrations. One should not attempt to undertake the things that actually drive us down. So without going into details, again, his whole point is that one must be aware of what is the opportune and proper time for engaging in particular kinds of ascetical practice, not simply keeping to an absolute rigid rule. Now, again, in his day, there did not exist the tradition that would exist today of what you might call a certain minimum expectation, for example, of those who are vowed or those who are in priestly orders and who are therefore obliged to certain spiritual practices. Evagrius predates that notion, and he certainly would never have said that one simply needs to easily and without thinking about it dispense oneself from one's proper and expected tasks. But his point is that in engaging in asceticism, one must have prudence and a careful sense of discretion. In number 42, he begins to introduce a subject that is described in more detail in the Anti-Rheticos. He says, and this might strike us as a little strange or even shocking, speak with anger to the demon who is pressuring you. He believed that the proper purpose of anger, the proper purpose of righteous indignation, was that it should be directed against the things that warp and distort us, that cause us not to be able to be in good relationship with God. That's really the only purpose, the only according to nature, kataphusin, use of anger. So his idea is that one needs to learn the proper words, the proper way of rebuking or repelling the demonic, that serves at the same time as a kind of a wake-up call to us, that this isn't something I should be dallying with. This is the very thing God gave me a capacity for righteous indignation for. God gives me the capacity to be angry, not so as to be angry at my brother or my sister who's offended me, but instead to look and to properly direct my indignation at the deeper cause, the real destructive origin of that of which they are simply the external representation. In number 43, he points out that one has to have experience of looking at one's own life in order to be able to understand, again, the kairos, the proper time, the occasions that are used by the demonic and which we need to be aware of, because he says we need to be able to interpret these kairoi as well. We have to be able to recognize what is the appropriate occasion for using this or that form of ascetical practice, this or that form of prayer, and more specifically, particular verses from the scriptures to help us be strengthened or to overcome particular difficulties that we're having. So he says that we can make progress with God's help when we are attentive to what is going on within the context of our own experience of temptation. And we'll see more about this in just a couple of sections. And number 46, he points out the very beautiful and central insight that, and he's describing here, the case of the demon who is tempting us towards blasphemy, the demon that tempts us to engage in just unthinkable kinds of acts. The real goal of the demon is not the acts themselves, but the fact that this causes us to abandon prayer. It creates within us a sense of shame and of separation from God that makes us believe that God doesn't want us to pray, or God's not going to listen to us. So he points out this very central notion that the goal of the demonic is to get us to abandon prayer, and our response should always be to enter back into prayer, not succumb to the false demonic temptation to believe that we are so guilty, so separated from God, that prayer is impossible, or approaching God is can't be thought of because we're unworthy. That's a demonic temptation to despair. So, in number 47, he expresses his conviction, which was not held universally by the later tradition, that it is only God who knows our mind, that God alone is kardiognostos, that God alone is capable of understanding the depths of the human soul, that he alone knows our innermost self. Evagrius believed that demons are able to tempt us only on the basis of what we say and of their interpretations of our actions, because there is within us this, if you will, deepest sanctuary, which is the presence of God, the true presence of God, a kind of a glowing light of the divine presence given us at our creation and strengthened and recreated, as it were, in baptism, and, as we'll see, which he believed can even be sensed in prayer. The demons don't know this, can't know this, and in a sense can't be there. There remains that within us which can only be known by, embraced by, and occupied by God. So if we go then down to number 50, he points out that it is important to keep a record. Now, this can be an interior mental record, or there's some suggestion that the word he uses, semeustho, may refer to noting down or keeping a written record. That's debatable as to whether or not that's exactly what this term means, but certainly the overall thrust of this particular passage is that one should be aware of, learn from, be taught by the experience of one's temptation, so that it becomes data, it becomes information, which we can then make sense of. We are to be aware, he says, of the nature of our temptations, how intense they are, what causes them to fade, how they are interconnected with one another, their timing, their order, what comes first, what comes afterwards, what never seems to be present when other kinds of things are present. And then most importantly, this is not simply a question of our figuring this stuff out. The most important thing that is we should, as he puts it, seek from Christ the inner meanings, the logoi, of these things, of this experience of temptation. We are to engage in a contemplative appreciation of the experience of our temptation, which means to see it within the context of Christ's love, to see it as something that Christ wants to offer us the meaning to. We are to pray, to seek the meaning from Christ in our own prayer, also, as Evagrius will say elsewhere, in our conversations with our spiritual Abba or Ama, and most important of all, by searching the scriptures, by looking in the revealed Word of God, and in accordance with the reliable interpretation of the biblical text given to us by the tradition, we are to seek from Christ in these places the inner meanings of our own temptation. And this is a gnostikoteros, as he puts it, a way of engaging in this practice of asceticism with greater knowledge, but one might also say with a greater capacity for contemplation. If we drop down then, beginning at number 54, he tries to interpret the experience of dreams and of sleep as more data, not just a kind of an incomprehensible sending from some divine or demonic source, but the experience of sleep to be, again, like everything else, to be places where we experience our state of spiritual growth or progress and our need to change, our need to continue growing. So these two are also places where we ultimately seek the meaning of these experiences from Christ himself. And we can tell, he says, from our dreams, in number 56, the extent to which we're making progress. To what extent are our temptations in dreams vivid or rather more vague? And again, one may not necessarily agree with everything that he says, but his goal is to allow that the whole of one's inner life, the whole of one's interior experience, becomes something that one engages in a dialogue with the Lord about. My inner life is a place where I can see something of my spiritual progress. And again, this is also a process that is engaged in with the advice of and with the guidance of a spiritual Abba or Amma. In number 57, he describes what he calls a state approaching apatheia, this freedom from what we would call compulsion or addiction. We know that we're moving toward this kind of inner freedom when we're able to distinguish between the fact that we can be peaceful, he says, for a couple of reasons. One is a kind of a natural peacefulness, and it's good. It follows, and there is associated with it a sense of humility, of compunction, of longing for God, and even tears of joy and of repentance, an eagerness for what we do. If that's the kind of a peaceful state that we have, it's in accordance with our own nature, and it's the gift of God and the gift of, you know, the angelic powers. But there's also a peaceful state which means that the demons are just watching for their opportunity, and we can tell that that's happening when we are subject to or indulging in vainglory and pride. If we are congratulating ourselves about what a wonderful job we've done in making spiritual progress, watch out, that peacefulness will probably be short-lived and probably followed by renewed and even worse temptation. In number 58, he offers a very controversial bit of advice, which was particularly disliked by some authors in the later tradition. St. John of the Ladder, St. John Climacus, particularly thought this was dangerous and even reckless to advise those who are sort of beginning in the spiritual life. Evagrius points out that if we are proud of our spiritual progress, which is a kind of vainglory, then we will have a natural bulwark against certain kinds of temptations, such as lust. We'll be too proud to allow ourselves to engage in a kind of immoral fantasy. And so he calls this using a nail to drive out a nail. If I'm troubled by one kind of temptation, I could even dally with a certain kind of vainglory so as to allow that other to be something that I have disdain for. But he points out, then you have the problem of getting rid of the vainglory. And again, this is regarded as what you might call a practice or a technique that would only be recommended to the advanced. But notice that he himself points out that it would be far better to employ humility to drive away the vainglory, or chastity to drive away sexual immorality, an awareness not just of one's spiritual success, of how wonderful one is, but how God invites us to a kind of balance in our capacity for desiring, which itself should be attractive. And this, he says, would be a sign of very profound apatheia, of having made great spiritual progress. If we drop down then a little further to number 64, what he calls the signs of apatheia, he says that one can tell that one is being liberated from a tendency towards obsession or compulsion or addiction by the capacity at prayer, he puts it, to begin to behold your own proper gentle radiance, oikeion phengos. He describes this in his writings on prayer and elsewhere in a way that the later Byzantine tradition particularly emphasizes, as we've mentioned, in the practice of the Jesus Prayer, a sense of an interior light that is experienced during prayer. And he says that this is a sign when one has this, an awareness of what you might call the light of Christ, the presence of God within the self, and a sense of tranquility even at night when one is asleep. And when we look at ordinary things, the pragmata, with calmness, this is a sign that God really is working within us and we are cooperating with God and making real spiritual progress towards a capacity to understand our inner lives and not be caught up or manipulated by the experience or the events associated with temptation. He's convinced that that knowledge, that contemplation, allows the self to be lifted up, as he puts it, on high in number 66. And we'll catch another glimpse of this when he talks about the work of the angels in one's life. And in number 69, he says, and we'll come back to this when we look at psalmody next week, that although it's a wonderful thing to pray without distraction, it's even greater, more difficult, to sing psalms without distraction. The act of psalmody that focuses on the inner meaning, the true contemplative center of the verse or the psalm that we are singing, that kind of task can sometimes be even more difficult than simply to be present to God without distraction. So there is a very great grace of prayer and of psalmody that consists in the ability to focus and be aware of God. And again, we'll come back to this idea later. He recommends psalms and hymns as ways of calming one's interior capacity for indignation. We've talked about that and seen that earlier in the Practicos. And then in number 76, he talks about the rejoicing of the angels, which come to us in order to fill us with spiritual contemplation. The angels desire to give us pneumatike theoria, spiritual contemplation. So he believes that our experience of beholding the deeper meanings, the beauty, the glory of God in creation is itself a mediated gift, something that we receive through angelic ministration, which is for him the opposite and the positive and proper use of one's capacity for contemplation, but the opposite of the experience of temptation, which is the result of the demonic activity. Then in number 79, he points out that this act of contemplation is necessary for the healing of the deeper innermost self. It's not enough simply to keep the commandments. One needs to see into them, to perceive into the commandments, and thus through them the God who lies behind them. This will be the healing of the noose, he hints at in number 79. And then number 82, there is a beautiful passage about the recognition of one's own power, understanding that which interferes with us, and then the discovery of the commandment, which may well mean the text from the scriptures, as we'll see when we look at the Antireticos, that can heal. We need to have available to us many spiritual remedies that can be applied in times of temptation. And the goal will be, as he says in number 83, to contemplate the logoi, the inner meaning, the purposes of this interior battle, this interior war. Then a very beautiful summary that's carried out in more detail in chapter 86, a brief summary. He says that our soul is working according to nature, kataphusin, when our epithumia, our desire, longs for virtue, our indignation, our spirited part, fights for virtue, and our reasoning, logisticon, the highest ruling, governing part of the self, applies itself to the contemplation of things that have come into being, of creatures, of creation, of that which God has made. And now he gives, in number 89, a beautiful depiction, and this is quite unique in Christian literature, a beautiful, detailed depiction based and almost entirely taken from an Aristotelian text, probably a Stoic text, on the virtues and vices, which he adapts and modifies and uses as a way of dividing up and defining what the virtues are for which a person is striving. I've color-coded it slightly. The light blue is the logistikon, the ruling part, responsible for prudence, understanding, and wisdom. This concupiscible or desiring part is to produce the virtues of temperance, charity, and self-control, and the thumakon offers courage and patience. And then a little further down, there's a greater description of each of these, and I'd like us to look in particular at what I've listed as number 2A. The work of temperance, he says, is to look serenely upon the affairs that provoke within us irrational fantasies. Real temperance means that the things that formerly drove us into a frenzy, either of desire or whatever, no longer have that effect upon us. That's what the virtue of temperance is about. Not to pretend that those things don't exist, but to be able to behold them in a way that is characterized by apatheia, with serenity. Charity, agape for him, consists in looking at all the images of God, that is to say, other human beings who are created in God's image, and interacting with them as the image of God. Real charity means I see God in you and I treat you as the image of God, even though the demons have engaged in the work of trying to corrupt and to deface all that which bears God's image. So I can look at the other seeing both that which is warped and defaced and also the image of God, and that's how I view myself as well. Charity means interacting with that which bears God's image, applying to it and offering it the dignity that it is entitled to as being created in God's image, while being aware of what still needs to change and being willing to be a part of that process of change. Then he concludes, beginning at chapter 91, his Practikos with a series of apothegmata, of sayings of the Desert Fathers, which you're welcome to read on your own. I'll just note one or two very brief things that are worth looking at. Number 93, which is a citation, he says, from Macarius the Egyptian, in which he describes again that there is a natural way of using memory, and that is to say that the natural purpose of memory, the natural purpose of our capacity for indignation, is to destroy or dispel that which comes from the demons. And so it's understandable, he says, that we are unharmed if we resent the demons, but we ruin our power of memory if we brood resentfully on others. So we are not to direct our indignation against the sister or brother, but again on the demonic, which is the real origin or cause of the warping or malformation that we see. Just one final word on the Practikos, and that is that you can see that this manual or handbook intends that those who use it or read it should be involved in a process of dialogue with someone who can help them open their soul, but it's also intended to give a person the capacity to engage in the work of deepening in their understanding of their own spiritual journey on their own, learning the resources that will enable them to function between visits or between experiences of someone who can offer them spiritual guidance. So this kind of a text is really intended to teach the art of spiritual guidance and enable others then to become of benefit to others in their turn.